is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, hoop heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish home machine. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Pat Baldwin, head men's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com.
This was a good year for us. It's a good year for minority coaches. A lot of guys got opportunities, and I hope to take advantage of it, because in the end, they will say, you know what? I want to get a guy like him. And that makes more opportunities for us. And that's the tough part of this business.
Welcome to Episode 8 of our Hoopheads podcast series called Mentality with Dwayne Killings, Season 1 at UAlbany. The series will document Dwayne's first year as the head men's basketball coach at the University at Albany. We plan to record and release 2 to 4 episodes per month with Dwayne and our players, coaches, administrators, media members, and others associated with the Great Danes basketball program to get an inside look at what being a first-year head coach at the Division I level is all about. Today, we're joined by Bruiser Flint, associate to the head coach at the University of Kentucky. Bruiser and Dwayne first met when Bruiser was coaching at UMass and Dwayne was attending UMass basketball camp as a kid. Dwayne eventually played for Bruiser at UMass, and the two men developed a bond that continues to this day. In this conversation, we dive deep into their relationship and the impact their friendship has had on their coaching careers. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Take some notes and be prepared to learn as you listen to this episode with UAlbany head coach Dwayne Killings and University of Kentucky assistant coach Bruiser Flint.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here tonight with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and we are pleased to be joined by the head coach at the University at Albany, Dwayne Killings, and the associate to the head coach at the University of Kentucky, Bruiser Flint. Bruiser, welcome to the pod. Dwayne, welcome back.
What's up, man? Good to see you.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. Appreciate you having me on.
We are excited to have you on, be able to dive into the relationship that you and Dwayne have built over the many years of your career, talk a little bit about the profession of college basketball coaching, and just kind of get you guys' perspective on where we're headed and what's going to be happening with Dwayne at UAlbany. And then, Bruiser, we can get into what you've been able to do at Kentucky and what you guys have to look forward to. So, Dwayne, let's start with you and just give us an idea of how you and Bruiser got together, how you met, and just kind of give us the background on your relationship.
Yeah, I was fortunate to grow up in Amherst, Massachusetts as a young boy. My dad worked at the university for 40 some odd years. And, when I was growing up, probably 6-7 years old, John Calipari comes rolling into town and really ignited a fire in the town. I mean, he built a program. There was excitement. He was a unifier. He really marketed the program. And, they had a program called Mini Minutemen where young kids would do drills, at halftime of games, and you would come in after a practice and do the whole deal. But I was fortunate to meet, Bruiser when he's an assistant coach. And I think he yelled at me a couple of times, but I loved it. And, he was always great to my dad. My dad worked at the university as the assistant controller of the university. And, there weren't a lot of Black people in the town of Amherst. So you kind of connected to each other in your own way. And my dad was very much a mayoral figure on campus. So people kind of knew my dad, and I was young and Bruiser would invite us into practice. I come in there and I turned into be a ball boy. And, what started out as just a assistant coach and a local kid in town started to turn into like family when I turned into a walk-on. And then, he's a guy I went to for advice as my career grew and decided to become a father and a husband and all those things. I mean, he was a guy that I turned to for every corner, every moment, change in my life. And now I look at him as a uncle, father figure, advice giver. And, what's really cool though, is that, when I was at Temple, he was the head coach at Drexel. Like we started hanging out and we became really friends, our relationship changed so much over time. Now he hasn't gotten any older, right? I've gotten older. He looks the same as he did back then, back when we were in Amherst back in the 90s. And I think he had a Grand Am back then. So we got him out of that.
Yeah, I got the Grand Am. I started driving Lincolns. That made a little bit different now, right? The Grand Am, definitely. I remember the Grand Am.
Yeah, I remember the
Lincoln a little bit more.
Everybody's car choice changes as we get a little older, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, so Bruiser, what do you remember about those days? What do you remember initially back at UMass, meeting Dwayne for the first time, his father? Just talk a little bit about the genesis of your guys' relationship.
Well, actually, his dad was there. He used to come to practice. And I remember Dwayne as a camper. He was, like you said, a mini Minuteman. And he was a camper and he used to come by. But his dad was always there. His mom, his dad and his mom would come over, my wife, couple of the people on campus. We used to have little get-togethers and go and have dinner and everything before he even became part of what we were doing. So then he got to the point where he was a high school kid. He was going to college and he became a guy who was a walk-on for my team. So, the relationship started a long way back before he even thought about being like my part of coaching. Because of his dad and his mom, and we used to hang out and do a lot of things. There's a few couples in the Amherst area used to go out and do some things and come over each other's house and drink and play cards and do all those stuff like that. So then, boom, he all of a sudden he becomes an adult, and he moves to Philly. He works for a good friend of mine, Fran Dunphy. He actually also too was a good friend of mine with the Charlotte Hornets. And when he came to Philly, we started being together. We started going to hang out, go dinners, do all those things like that. And next thing you know, this guy, he becomes a person who becomes very special to me. He and his wife, who was a UMass grad also too, we started to be really close. And, it just went from there. Being in Philly, we didn't live too far away from each other. We would go out, we would have dinner, we would do all those things like that, talk coaching, so it became family. really became family, although it started with his mom and dad, you know, it became him and his wife. So those types of things that, you know, that happened. And I actually put them down with the guys that were part of my family from Philadelphia. The guys who played for me at Drexel became his people too. So that's became, that was one of the things that, you know, became one of the things that became kind of special. And it was good to hang out with them. As you, I saw those guys grow, you know, I remember them as like a 8, 9, 10 year old. Now all of a sudden becomes a man and you see what they do. You know what I mean? And you know, it becomes one of those things where we start to hang out a little bit, talk profession, do all those types of things. And that's where it went from there.
Did you know, did you see Dwayne as a coach back in the day when you first met him? Did you see him having sort of that mindset as a player where you thought, hey, maybe at some point this guy might end up being a coach? Or was it not really, were you not really thinking in that direction back at that time?
I'll be honest with you. No, I didn't. I'll be honest with you. But I will say one thing about him was everybody loved Dwayne. He was the connector to all the players on the team. Everybody loved him. Everybody was a guy who, you know, went around them and they wanted to be around him all the time. So when he decided to get into this profession, I know he was going to be a guy who got along with everyone because everybody loved him. And he was a guy who would bring people in to the family that might not necessarily be into the family. So, you know, we would keep in touch. And when he came to Philly and I put him in, down with all the guys, I met all the other people that he had connected with throughout his career. And we all became one. I mean, that's the one thing about him, ultimate connector. I will say that about him, ultimate connector. And he was a guy who really felt like he could put everybody together. I had my family. He had his family. We're going to put our families together because we're all part of family. That's the one thing I will say about him that is very special that he always does.
Do you think that's, Dwayne, something that came naturally to you? Is that ability to connect people? Is that something that you consciously had to work at? I know we've talked before that you felt like your dad had something similar in him as you were growing up and you watched the relationships that he was able to build with all different kinds of people throughout his career. So do you feel like that was something that came to you pretty naturally that, hey, I'm in this group and now I'm connecting people and I'm connecting this group to that group? Or is that something that you more consciously had to work on because you potentially saw that, hey, I can really put people together? Which one of those better describes kind of how you feel about it growing up?
Yeah, I think that was something I learned from my dad. You know, if Bruiser came to town and needed somewhere to live or was trying to figure out something in the town, he took that on as his problem, but that was his way of connecting people. And I watched it. And then also, you know, I watched Bruiser and Coach, you know, Cal and Bill Baino and Jeff Arnold and all these guys come through Amherst and they connected people. You know, they made the community feel smaller. So I watched it and I learned it. And that was like what I felt like was my advantage in this business. Like, again, I didn't have the career of somebody like Monty Mack, you know, that played at UMass. But what I did have is I worked hard, I paid attention, I listened, and I knew how to connect people. And that's a skill that you need in our business, whether it's motivating players, connecting to donors, or just trying to get your team to really buy into a mindset and into a philosophy. I think those are all things I learned from, you know, like I said, from Bruiser, from Coach Cal, watching those guys at practice and do what they did in the community as a young boy. And also watching, you know, my dad do those things in his own unique way for many years.
Do you remember the first piece of advice you ever got from Bruiser when it came to coaching? Like the first conversation where it sort of transitioned to, hey, this guy can sort of serve as a mentor for me. Does anything stick out in the early part of your career? Something that he told you early on that really has helped you?
Patience. I remember being an operations. No, every operations guy thinks he can be an assistant coach right away. I remember we were at a Urban Saloon in Philly, which is like kind of like the midway point for where I lived and where he lived, and we'd hang out there. I remember my brother-in-law was there, and I was dying to be an assistant coach. And he told my brother-in-law, and he told me, just be patient; it will happen. And when it happens, everything moves really fast. You know, you get the job, and then you're trying to figure the job out. You know, and I remember that. I remember him telling me to make sure that the kids knew I was crazier than they were. But I also remember getting to Philly and he talked about the Philly community. Like once you understand it, like it's a unique place to be. And to be honest with you, living in Philly for 8 years, it made my career, my college coaching career. You know, those connections, those relationships were huge. And a lot of who I was is validated by Bruiser Flint and, you know, a really good friend of mine, Ashley Howard, who Bruiser was talking about, who played for him, and Jeff Arnold. Those guys kind of cemented who I was. So it gave me access to the city that a lot of people can't get without guys like them.
So Bruiser, tell me a little bit about Philly basketball. Maybe somebody who's not as familiar with it. What's so special about the city of Philadelphia when it comes to basketball? I mean, obviously we all know the Big Five and the Palestra, and there's things that a lot of people who are college basketball fans know, but maybe what's something that we don't know that makes the Philly basketball community so special that you were able to tap into or be a part of?
Well, I grew up playing college ball there. I mean, high school ball, but the connections. So one thing about Philly is a very tight knit community. So you got to be a part of it or they put you on the side. You know what I mean? So that was the one thing. So you got to have a connection. If you don't have a connection, you're going to be on the outside looking in.
They're going to boo you like they booed Santa, man. You got to let go.
But I mean, that's the big thing about it. I think if you do a good job of being a part of the guys who are part of the city, who grew up there, who played there, who do all those things, then it becomes a lot easier. If you're not, it becomes hard. They put you out of it. And I think one of the big things about Dwayne was, you know, once he got to the city, he got to know some of the guys and the young guys of his age that made him part of the city itself. So when he goes to Temple and he works for Fran Dumpy and he meets up with Ash puts him down with a lot of people that's going on, that's involved with the people in the city, and they accept him, although he's an outsider. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the big things right there. If you're an outsider, you don't do the things that you need to do, then make sure that you stay an outsider. But if you're a guy that comes in, guys put you down, hey, he's good with me. Then you handle it the right way, they'll make you an insider. I think that's the biggest thing about Philadelphia. Although Philly is a big city, it's a small city. And the basketball community definitely is very small. If you've ever been around the Philadelphia guys, and they tease us about it actually in recruiting, when we go recruiting, all the Philly guys sit together. And if you're not part of it, you're not sitting with us that day as we watch games and we're around each other. They'll let you know, yo, you're not a part of this. But I thought Dwayne did a great job of being a part of that stuff. And if you ask anybody, they would say Dwayne is a Philly guy, which he's not. He's from Amherst. But he did a good job of navigating it and being part of what we were doing as a family. Of course, he was part of my family because he played for me at UMass. And I made sure that the guys that played for me in the Philadelphia area accepted him. But if he wasn't a good guy, they would say, bro, no, we're not dealing with him. But he was. And that's one of the things I think that made it pretty special for him and gave him an opportunity to do the things that he'd be able to do in Philadelphia.
When did you know you wanted to coach?
Me?
Yep.
When I was my dad ran a recreation center and I was a freshman in college and he's run what they call biddy leagues, 6th, 7th, 8th graders. So one day he said to me, all right, look, man, I need you to help me take the kids to the game. So we get to the game. The other team's coach wasn't there. So he said to me, you coach my team, I'll coach the other team. And I coached the team that after the game, because my dad was a little crazy. My dad used to smack him. You know, this is back in the day. Back in the day, you know what I mean?
It was a little different then, man.
Scream and holler at him, cuss at him. You know, those were those days back then. So my dad said to me, coach the other team. So when I coach the other team, they asked me, are you going to come back next week? Right? I was like, sure, why? Because your dad is crazy. That's what he said. And I'll be honest with you, I started loving it. And I was in college at the time, 8 a.m. Saturday mornings. If you're a college guy, you know, Friday, Saturday nights, You know what I mean? You get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and go coach a big league team. You got to be dedicated because, you know, most of the time you wasn't coming in until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning anyway. So so I did that. That's when I know, you know what? I got the bug. And then Jim O'Brien, who was a big women's coach at the time, he was the St. Joe's coach. He coached at Vanderbilt, he coached at Ohio State. And now he's a coach at Murray State. He said to me, you should get in coaching. I was like, I don't know about that. He said, look, I watched the women's game because the women used to play with Forrest. The young girls used to play in Forrest, and I used to coach a little bit. He said, this would be a good profession for you. And that got me interested in it.
What did you like about it right off the gun? I mean, what was it about coaching that team that first time? What was it about coaching that excited you?
One, I love the kids. You know what I mean? If you don't love the relationship with the kids, you're in the wrong profession. Because it can be hard, because the kids can be hard. But you have to love the young people. And Coach Chaney told me this a long time ago. He said to me, when we were talking, I said, I'm not going to do this till I'm 70. And he said, one, the young guys have made a lot more money than the old guys made when they first got in it. But he said, the kids give you energy. And it's true. They give you energy. They keep you in it. They keep you strong. They keep you young. And I think that's the biggest thing about it. And then relationships. Seeing a guy like Dwayne makes you feel really proud. You know what I mean? See him growing up as a 10, 11, 12-year-old guy. Being to be a part, be successful. See him grow up and be able to do the things he'd be able to do. For me, it's very emotional. Almost to the point where I almost cry. You know what I mean? Seeing him doing, I've known his wife since she was in college. You know what I mean? So to see them be able to have that journey, be able to go on and do good things. I mean, for me, there's nothing better than that. Because one thing, you know, you're a part of it. You know, you're a part of, okay, bro, I'm going to call you when I want to get a job. I'm going to call you when, what do you think about this? And that's the biggest thing about coaching that makes you proud. That you're a part of the transition of those guys, but not becoming men, young men, but becoming men. I think that's the biggest thing right there. There's nothing like that that makes you feel proud. And I've had some guys in my days who they were tough kids. To see them have success with families and do all those things. I'm an old head in this business now. So now they send me his kids, you know what I mean, things like that. That make me feel good. And listen, the first kid he had, I go over his house. His mom made him and his wife made me take off my shoes, do all those things like that. You know what I mean? You come in the house, take your shoes off, do all those things. To the second kid, where it was like, it don't matter, just come on in. You know? But to see those guys, you know, to raise family, raise kids. I'm old enough to know to see my guys be able to have kids that go to college and do well in college, even if they weren't basketball players. And those are things that you preach throughout the world. You do it throughout them. Well, you know, when you're coaching them, to see them and be able to do that, that's unbelievable. You know what I mean? It becomes very emotional, and that's the thing. And Dwayne has been very special in that way. I'm very close to his family. His wife and his kids and all those things like that. So to be able to do that, that makes it very special for me growing up. I'm an old guy. So, you know, I see that and it makes me feel really good.
Dwayne, heading into the interview process at UAlbany, what did you reach out to Bruiser for when you guys have a conversation? What does that conversation look and sound like when you're talking to him about potentially going to UAlbany, interviewing for the job, whether or not I'm going to take the job? What's that conversation sound like?
You know, he talking about the job, you know, he's like, it's a no brainer if you can get it. And I think his big question was, can you get it? And then preparing for some of the questions, you know, here's some of the questions they're going to ask you, but here's some things to think about. And I think after talking to him, you know, he makes you really confident about what you're going to do. And I remember even before going through this process, just one day we were talking and he said, guys make a really big mistake. They go in with a predetermined way they want to coach their team. Where really you got to look at what you have and figure out how you have to adjust. right? Based off your talent and what you have. And I think his perspective, because there's not a lot of people that have the respect and have had the success that, you know, Bruiser Flint has had. So when he talks, people listen. And then, you know, it's so funny, like you go into these interviews and, you know, you start talking about your journey and then you bring up his name and it's like disarms people because they have a story. Like my AD remembers him like giving it to a referee, but like when he was at ODU, but like the thing that he said is he respects him because, you know, he's like, he speaks his mind and he holds his ground and it says a lot. And I think people immediately they say like, hey, if you know this guy and associate yourself with him, you know, you're a high character person and you believe in caring for people and doing things a certain way. Same thing after working for Fran Dunphy. So I'm lucky to have two of those people, you know, instill certain things into my life. But I think the other thing was like when it was happening, he's like, you got a shot to get this job, you know, because you start talking about who you're meeting with and who you're talking to and what's happening and how fast it happens. And then, you know, boom, the next time I talk to him, it's like, yo, I just watched your press conference. You almost made me cry watching you walk up there and do your thing on the stage. You know, because everybody watches the press conference. Like I had him watching it and, you know, JB Bickerstaff is the head coach of the Cavs and a bunch of other people. And everybody's trying to see, okay, well, what are you going to say when you get up there? You know, they know you a different way. They see you in a different light. And then when they see you, you know, present yourself as a leader of a program, they're like, yeah, that's my guy. You know what I mean? But he's a part of that story and that journey. And as I articulate my vision and what I'm trying to do, half of that stuff I learned from him. When I became my first assistant coaching job, I remember this, bro. I was with Ajmal Bassett in Boston, Massachusetts. I had just gotten the BU job. We went to the mall and I was going to get some clothes. Like, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting my Bruiser Flint startup kit. I got some Pohunk, some slacks, and a polo. Cause that's, I mean, I looked at Bruiser like that's success, right? So let's get the uniform. I can't buy the, you know, the Gucci shoes that he had, but I'm gonna get the Kohans. I'm gonna get the knockoff look, but that's what you do. And then when you get up on the stage or you have your moments, you know, you're just a product of your experiences. And he's a big part of mine.
Bruiser, when you think about, and maybe you don't even have to be specific to Dwayne's situation, but when somebody comes to you who you've maybe served as a mentor to, and they're asking you for your advice, how do you approach those conversations where you want to give them a sounding board, you want to give them your opinion, you want to share with them, but yet you don't want to maybe tell them exactly what they should do. You want them to figure it out. So how do you approach those conversations when somebody comes to you with a specific question about, hey, what should I think about this job? Or how should I prepare for this interview? How do you go into those kinds of conversations? What's your thought process as you're talking to somebody like Dwayne, who you're trying to help get through whatever it is, whatever issue that they're facing? How do you approach those conversations?
Well, one of the things I always tell them is you got to be a professional. And one thing, I'm old school. You dress the part, you look the part, you talk the part. I mean, that's it. And that's part of being a professional. I want those guys, if looking, when people look at them and say, that guy is going to be a professional. He talked about being the Bruiser Flint startup kit, but you know, that's what happened when you're old school. When I came into the business, you wore a shirt and tie to work every day. And so one of the things about my guys, they always saw me was I was dressed apart. That's one of the things that they would say. And then the way you act, the way you talk. One of the things I always talked about the guys was, you know what I mean? When you get to this, in this situation, you want to be a guy who they look at and say, one day I want to hire him. That's one of the things I always talk to my guys about. So you're in an arena. They got to see you in an arena that they look at you and say, he can be an asset to me for the people who want to hire him. And I just talk about to my guys all the time. I'm very proud. Kills, Ash Howard, Bashir Mason, those guys are head coaches. They work for me. They hire guys who were part of our family. And that's one of the other things I preach. I preach family. You know, lift the guys who are part of what we're doing. Get them an opportunity to. So that's one of the things I talk about to them. But I think the biggest thing is when they look at you, they want to look at you as being a professional. One thing about Kills, unbelievable reputation in this business. That's why it becomes a head coach. people say to me, man, Kills is unbelievable. He connects people. He's a professional. He's done well. He had an unbelievable reputation within the business. That's how you become a head coach. I hope in them watching me and being part of what I do, that that was part of what made them become a head coach. You know, I look at those guys and like I said, I get a little emotional because I know how far they've come. I've had some conversations with them that might not necessarily be able to say, yo, dude, you're not going to be a professional when you get older. But that's one of the things I hope that they looked at me and said, Bruce is a role model of being a professional. And that's one of the things about Kills. When he came through the business, the one thing everybody always said to me was, man, this guy, he's an unbelievable professional. You know what I mean? And he handles himself well. He does the appropriate things. He do all those things. I hope that he learned that from me. He might not necessarily, because his dad was like that. He comes from an unbelievable background. You know, and his dad and his mom were great people. But I hope I had a little bit how he became, because that would make me proud. But and all this stuff, I would say the one thing I always try to make my guys feel is though, like, if you want to be successful in this business, got to be a professional first. How you present yourself is a big. And I think the guys that I talked about, Bosh, Ash, and Kills, they're unbelievable in terms of their presentation.
Hey, Hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com.
Who served in that role for you when you were a young coach?
John Calipari. John Calipari, he was definitely, without a doubt, he taught me how to be a pro. Frank Mitchell gave me the opportunity to be an assistant coach at Coppin State. But when you talk about smorgasbord, you know what I mean, handle your money, do what you're supposed to do, handle yourself as a professional, I say that goes to John Calipari. I think that's one reason why I became sort of best friends. He took me I always tell everybody, I went from driving them to the meetings to being in the meetings. And I think that's one of the things that as time went on, I learned about being a professional. And I think that's a big reason why I was a head coach for 20 years. I'll be honest with you also too, when I did get fired, I think people who hired me said, this guy's a great professional. And then when I wanted to get back into coaching, but John Calipari was a big deal for me and how my career went and the things I do later on in my career.
Dwayne, talk about the influence that Bruiser had on you as a professional, like you just talked about.
I can remember being at Temple in the summertime, going over to Drexel, and the presentation part was always like who he was. Like, he's always one of the best dressed coaches in college basketball, so he set the standard high. But even like, he did a great job of like calling you out if you didn't look the part, in a very subtle but direct way. But I thought, like, when I go to Drexel and I try to do it here, just stopping and appreciating people, whether it's the compliance person or the academics person or the soccer coach coming through the halls, because, you're a certain kind of figurehead being a head coach, and people are constantly evaluating you and they want your time. And, you have to shift really fast. I could be in his office and he's trying to figure out something with recruiting or his team, and he walks on the hallway and we're about to go get a sandwich. And, he might be upset about something, but when the soccer coach comes, you got to change quickly. And he knew how to do that. And that's an important skill. I think when I look at being a leader of a program, and I talk about this a lot, and it's something that he talked about a lot when I was playing on his team and when I was hanging around his teams at Drexel, I'm going to coach you hard, but I'm also going to love you up, really hard. And we're going to have a really good relationship and we're going to hang out. And he was big on having team meals or getting the staff together or taking all the guys out in Philly together. And when you do those things now, if I'm messing up as an assistant coach at Temple, or if Ashley Howard's having some struggles when he was at Villanova, he can have a really hard conversation because we have a real relationship. And for our program here, relationships are everything. I learned that from him. And I watched him, you know, drive people to success. And that's hard to do in this business because kids don't like that. But if they believe that you have a vested interest and you really love and care for them, they'll let you do anything because they know it's out of love. And he always did that. And, you know, whether it was, I remember, you know, Monty Mack scoring his 2000th point, he cried, you know, because he was proud of him. And I remember, you know, when he lost his opportunity to lead the program at UMass, you know, he wasn't really upset and crying because of the situation. He was mad because he was going to be disconnected from his team, you know, from his sons. And that's a real thing. That's a real emotion. That's real. And I don't know if there's that many authentic people in this business, because he's right. I mean, I think all of us in that circle value people. And when you value people, it's just a different deal. It's not transactional. And I think if it's not transactional, you have a chance to do some transformational things.
How do you make sure, Bruiser, that the kids that you coach know that that's the way that you feel about them, both on and off the floor, that allows you to coach them hard and maximize what they can be both as basketball players and as people? What's the key to your success in that area? What do you attribute that to?
Well, you got to spend time with them without them knowing that it's not about basketball. So I've always been a guy who brings them over the house, go to eat with them, BS with them a little bit. It's not all about, well, you're not playing well, or, you know what I mean, or you need to work on your jump shot. You know, you talk rap music, you talk all those types of things like that. And out of that too, you let them bust on you a little bit, because that was one of the things about my players. They would get on me about some of this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, yo, bro, you know what I mean? You ain't got the good shoes on today, or things like that. But
your shoe game better be strong,
yes,
right?
Yes, you better be strong. But, you know, you got to let them know I love you away from basketball. And it's more than that. You know, I grew up, you know, I worked at Coppin State. I worked at UMass. I worked at Drexel. Everybody wasn't going to be a pro. So the thing you had to let them know was, let's have success beyond basketball, because after your 4 years, your basketball could be done. So I wanted them to feel comfortable. I always used to tell my guys, don't be a jersey, because when you take that jersey off, somebody else is putting it on. You know, make sure that you're, you know, a part of the arena, that people look at you and say, you can be an asset to them when it's all said and done. You're just not a basketball player. I try to teach those types of lessons. But I wanted those guys, because I was a hard coach. You know what I mean? I cussed, I hollered, I called you names. But I think once those guys realize that you really care for them beyond basketball, then you could coach them that hard. And you would help them way beyond basketball. It's not just about being a basketball player. So I think that's been a big part of when I was a head coach, my career. I think that's one reason why, as a family, we're good as a family. The guys that Kills play with, we're still the family. We're on text threads together. We, you know, we laugh and joke. My guys at Drexel, they're on the same way. My guys at Drexel are good with guys at UMass that I coach. So I think that's one of the things that I try to stress and let them know we're all the family, because we're part of this basketball family. And I let them know that.
Dwayne, how do you make sure that happens with the kids you coach?
Well, that journey starts for us next week. You know, we made a big investment for our program. You know, we went and visited every kid in our program in their homes, because we wanted to preach family. We wanted to preach relationships and build them and get inside their own spaces, get inside their homes and understand what those look like. Tomorrow we're going to do a Zoom call, and, you know, my wife's going to come on it. It's important for me that our players and their parents know my wife. She presents a huge role in this process. And if me as a head coach, if things are disconnected at home, then I'm not going to be connected in the office as a head coach and a leader of a program. So I want them to to know that when they come in the building and they see her, I want them to feel like they know her and they can, you know, welcome each other and they have, you know, some level of relationship. But, you know, we're going to do a lot this next 6 weeks. You know, we have a leadership academy. We're going to do things on campus where we're going to get vulnerable and have real conversations, because if we're going to grow in that manner, the way he's talking about, we got to have hard conversations to get to know who we are and be able to be vulnerable and really grow. And again, going back to it, I remember being a walk-on and like one of the first 4 or 5 team meetings that we ever had, we got in a circle and the things that people opened up to about their lives was incredible. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And I was 18 years old and hearing, and that's what really drew me to coaching, like hearing all these different people's worlds and perspectives and experiences were coming into one room and you were becoming a second family to each other and trying to work hard to achieve one goal. And he drove that. And, you know, some really unique things happened in that experience.
What, give us an example, Bruiser, of something like that. Like, I guess, I don't know if team building activity is the right way to say it, but just how do you get your guys to open up to not only to you, but to one another? Because I think that's important when you talk about there's a coach-player relationship, but then you also have that player-to-player relationship that becomes really important, where when those guys are out on the floor, if they know each other at a deeper level and if they're trusting each other and they're playing for each other, you're going to end up probably having a more connected team and a more successful team. So what are some things that you do to build player-to-player relationships? What have you done over the course of your career in that area?
One, I'm not afraid to bring a guy in my office and say, all right, let's sit down, let's talk. So I think that's the one thing. It is different for kids nowadays than it was in the past. And I wasn't afraid to, if it wasn't as personal, to sit and talk about with the other guys what I talked with him about. I think that made it very open. I always had an open door policy. Come and talk to me. Not a big deal. If it's that personal, we can't talk to anybody else about it. Okay, fine. But if it's something that me and you discuss and I think will help the group, we'll discuss it. You know what I mean? So it's not embarrassing. And I would ask the kid, I'm going to talk to the other guys about this. Now, they could actually say, I don't want you to do that. Okay, fine. Just between me and you. I think that's the thing that made it where they trust you, where, you know, kids today, they get really more embarrassed than they used to do in the past. So that was one of my things that I thought over my years that I got comfortable with. But I always did it. So I would always sit down. I wanted everybody to be on the same page. That makes you have success. If you're not on the same page as players and as a coaching staff, it can be hard. But I always want everybody to be on the same page. Understand that we all have the same goals, that we may have some different issues, but our goals have to be the same. So that's one of the things I sort of stress to my teams. I got helped a lot with Joe Carr, who was a sports psychologist, who would talk to me how to deal with it. I brought him around my team. I did those things. But I thought that one of the things he helped me with was how to deal with each individual player and how to push each individual button, because everybody's not the same. But we all have to sign. We have to be about part of the same goals and what we have to do as a team to be successful. So I think that's one of the things that I always felt as though was one of my strengths as a coach. We're all together. Now, everybody know what we're going to do. Everybody know we're a little bit different. Everybody know each guy has different goals. But in the end, we have to come together.
Was it hard to, when you're coaching, is it difficult sometimes to treat the players differently so you're hitting the right buttons with each different player? Because obviously there's some guys that can respond to a little bit harsher treatment, harsher language. There's those guys that need to kick in the butt versus the guys who need you to put your arm around them, and they react differently. So how did you handle just dealing with the different psychology of each particular player to make sure that each guy was getting what they needed? And yet that there's one kid who's like, man, coach is always screaming at me because that seems to work for him. And then there's another kid. Well, why is he always putting his arm around this kid and I'm getting yelled at over here? How do you handle those kinds of issues, or how did you think about those?
One thing everybody know about when they play for me was everybody got screamed at.
Equal opportunity. There you go.
Never an issue. Like everybody from the first guy to the last guy know, oh, he going to scream at me at some point in time. And I'll be honest with you, that helped. You know what I mean? Like everybody knew he's going to react a certain way to each and every one of us. He's going to be hard on us, on each and every one of us. So then they didn't look at the next guy and said, he didn't do that to you. So I think that's one of the big things. Even my walk-ons, they would be like, yo, you got on us just as much as you got on the other guys on the team. So, but that made everybody comfortable. That means that you're not treating anybody differently. But you did treat people differently. You know what I mean? So, but everybody know a certain thing gets a certain reaction. And everybody knew that. And I think that was one of the things that made it easy for me, because I know I was a hard coach. You know, I mean, I wasn't easy. I got after you. And everybody had to look around and be able to say, okay, he didn't treat me. He didn't treat me no differently than the other guy. So I knew that was part of it. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's especially now. So I think it's a lot different this way. Your communicating skills have to be top notch, because these kids, they take it a little differently than they did in the past. In the past, you know, I'm a guy who been in this business for 35 years. People said, how does it change? It changed with the parents, and it changed with communication with the kids. If you're not a guy who really communicate with your kids, they're going to interpret it a little bit differently. And they're going to get, it's going to be a little bit more sensitive than it was in the past. But I think if guys look around and say, he didn't treat me differently than he treated anybody else, I think that then it's okay with them.
Dwayne, how do you look at that, the transition from being an assistant coach and the type of relationships that you have with players versus now as a head coach? And you think about, as an assistant, you're making suggestions. As the head coach, you're making decisions about who plays, who doesn't play. And obviously you haven't experienced that yet, and you'll have it this coming season. But as you start to just think about where you are now, what's going to be different about how you build that relationship with the players as the decision maker versus the assistant coach?
Yeah, I think you got to be really intentional. I mean, my time is taken differently. Like when I was working for Fran Dunphy or Steve Wojciechowski, you know, it was while he was off doing fundraising, I could focus on recruiting, you know, and I could bring a kid in my office and talk to him. My time is done different. And I think the advantage I've had in the business is probably my ability to build relationships. I think now I have to really plan it and be really intentional on how those things happen. And it's different. Like I felt it right away. Like practice would end, and if I was at Marquette and Justin Lewis was done, he'd come over and we'd hang out and talk. Now it's like guys are a little bit like, I don't know if I want to go over. He's the head coach. It's a different thing. And that's hard. You know, because sometimes you're left out of the joke. Sometimes, you know, it's like, there's another thing going on that you're not a part of. And that's weird, because I remember when I got the job, Coach Wojciechowski said to me, you know, it's great. It's lonely. And I get it. I got it really quickly, you know, because it's just different. You walk in a room, everybody stops talking. Like, why does everybody stop talking? You know, what are we talking about? But I think for me, I'm just trying to plan on like, hey, I want to invest the time in getting to know the guys. And I'm a laid back person off the court. And one of the things Coach Dunphy told me is you have no idea who you're going to be on the court. And I probably, I'm a product of my experiences. You know, Coach Wojciechowski was really intense. Bruiser Flint was really intense. Fran Dunphy was really intense. So I ended up being really intense. So I can blame them for my practice approach. But it's awesome. But that is something I got to manage. Because one of the things I don't have is I don't have the time that I could invest in relationships as an assistant coach. That's probably the biggest challenge. But you know, time's a commodity that none of us have enough of. I just got to find a way to find it and make it useful in a relationship category here.
How have you approached that same issue, Bruiser, as a head coach and then as an assistant coach? Do you approach the relationship piece of it the same, differently? What's it like building relationships with players as the head coach versus an assistant coach?
I mean, it definitely changes. You know what I mean? So you're not gonna, one of the things I told him was you can't do everything. That's one of the things that people think, well, I'm going to be this recruiter. You got to be able to delegate a little bit. You know what I mean? You got to be able to rely on your assistant coaches. You become the principal. When you get called to the principal's office, most people think something's wrong. But before, you call the assistant coach, yo, come over to my office. What's up, man? You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's over. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the transitions that you learn and becoming a head coach. The other thing I talked to him a lot about was, you know, you can't do everything. You're going to be pulled in a lot of ways away from your basketball court that you never got pulled as an assistant coach. So you have to be able to juggle those balls and be able to handle those types of situations, you know, from fundraising to just showing up and, you know, speaking to an alumni group. Those things become part of your repertoire that, to be honest with you, didn't have as an assistant coach. And you're doing it a lot because they need you to be a part of the athletic department that you've never been a part of the athletic department before. I think that's one of the things I talked to him about. And so you have to rely on your assistant coaches and have trust in your assistants to do a lot of things. What I was, it was, I called take food off your plate. If you don't have them take food off your plate, man, you're going to be too full to eat. And I think that's one of the things I sort of talked to him about a little bit. But your relationship with the players becomes a lot different because you're the hammer. You know what I mean? So, and they look at you that way. Don't think that you're going to, it's nothing wrong with being a hammer, though, because that's what it's all about. That's why you become a head coach. You're not going to always be their friend. You got to tell them the truth. You got to be honest with them. If you're not, you're not going to have any success. But there's nothing wrong with being a hammer, and that's part of your job. That's part of what you do. You got to be able to deal with it that way.
Bruiser, how long did it take you to get comfortable delegating to your assistants and to other people who are a part of the program? Was that something that you were able to do right away when you get your first head coaching job, or did that take you a couple of seasons to really feel like, hey, I can let this piece of it go and it's going to allow us to have more success? Because I think most of us who are driven and are successful, we do that because we believe in ourselves. We have a strong belief that I can do this really, really well. And yet, to your point, you have to let some of that go because you just don't have the time. So how long did it take you to feel comfortable delegating to your assistant coaches?
I will say this. The thing that was, when I got the UMass job, I recruited a lot of the players. So my relationship with them was different. Now all of a sudden, I become the head coach. And they still look at it like, yo, dude, you recruited me. You know what I mean? Right? So, like, dude, you're the guy that talked to me every day. Like, I'm not talking to you like that anymore. So I think that becomes different. Now, when I moved to Drexel and I hadn't recruited any of the players, it was totally different. So I think when you're in a situation where you take over from someone and you've been there, your relationship with the guys is totally different. If you go to somewhere new, then you know what? You have a different relationship with the guys. They're looking at you as the head coach from the beginning. Your relationship with the players is a little bit different in that way. But it takes you a couple of years because you have to build also the assistant coach's trust that, okay, I'm going to let this guy be able to do what I need to do to help me. And I think that takes a season or two to really be able to do it. You would always want a guy who is able to take care of things around campus. Forget about the players itself. Will he be able to help me out on campus where I'm not always dealing with the campus people that they know, you know what? I just call this assistant. You know, I know he'll be able to do it. He'll get it to brew. If it's to that point, you know, he'll get it to brew and we'll be able to work on it. I think that's one of the things that you learn over time. And you hope you have an assistant that's good at that, or else you're going to deal with it yourself. I think it takes definitely a season or two to let really know, and the people around them to really trust that guy that you put in that area to really be able to help you.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you learn as an assistant coach? I'm sorry, what did you learn as a head coach that's made you a better assistant coach?
To be honest with you, I think you're probably patience. You know what I mean? And I think the communication part of it, in terms of, you know, sitting down with the guys and really individually saying, hey, look, man, this is what you need to do. You know, I think that's one of the things. You don't always have to be their friend. I think sometimes with being an assistant coach, you always feel as though you got to be the player's friend. But you become a head coach, you realize you don't have to be their friend. And I think you can be more real with them. I think when I came back to be an assistant coach, when I kept it real with them. You know what I mean? We weren't selling no fantasies. You know what I mean? And they were like, okay, bro, I get it. You're real with me. And I get that. I think that made me a little bit better as an assistant coach. Me, myself, I had to learn how to do all the shit. Like, you know, you had to learn how to do the computer stuff and all that stuff like that, where you had somebody else doing it for you. You know what I mean? Now, all of a sudden, all right, bro, you got to clip a film. Clip a film? I ain't clipped a film in 20 years. You know what I mean? But, I mean, those types of things like that. But I think the biggest thing was, you know, just really keeping it real with them. I mean, not just being one of those guys that sort of like sells them a dream. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the things of being a head coach, being an assistant coach, I think it really helps.
Dwayne, one of the things that we've talked about a bunch of times already is just the responsibility that you feel as a young African-American coach getting your first opportunity to be a head coach. So maybe we jump into a little bit of the conversation that you guys have had in that area, talking about making sure that you do all the professional things that Bruiser, you were talking about earlier, and that Dwayne, you talked about, are so important to you. Just maybe talk a little bit about each of you, kind of what your conversations have been like over the years when it comes to the racial piece of being a head coach, being an assistant coach, being a college basketball coach. What are some of the things that you guys have talked about over the years through your course of your conversations?
Yeah, we're evaluated differently. I think Ashley Howard's success opened the door for my opportunity, and my opportunity opens the door for the next guy's opportunity. And that's something we have to be cognizant of. I think given what happened last year, I think we all kind of collaborated more. I mean, everybody's doing Zooms or we're having these conversations that they help you grow, but they're therapeutic. I mean, we're scrutinized differently. We're looked at differently. We have different challenges in our business. I think that's something that we're all cognizant of, but I think also we also have now positioned ourselves to address, celebrate, challenge for more diversity on campuses and in our profession, because we don't necessarily want it to be, hey, there needs to be one minority hire in every staff. Well, why can't there be two or three? What if that's the best person for the job? I think that's what everybody wants. I think now for me in this moment in my life and a bunch of guys that look like me, we've been given more opportunities. You know, Kyle Neptune's a really good friend of mine at Fordham. He's got his job. Now we all have to do a great job now for the next wave of guys, because we're going to be evaluated on that. But I think our window's shorter. And I think those are the things that Bruiser, you know, has identified and we've talked about over the years. Like, people are going to look at you differently. You know, they're going to evaluate your sideline antics. Sometimes we are looked at as, you know, we're too emotional, whereas somebody else might be looked at as passionate. Okay, that's something we got to deal with. I mean, that's just the reality of the world we live in. But I think at the end of the day, we got to be organized. We got to run good teams and got to have discipline and got to have the right identity for our players. Going back to what he said, professionalism is everything. Being a good teammate on the campus and in the community, that's important, because you're evaluated on all these things. But I think we're looked at a little bit differently. But obviously, for me, you know, I don't blend in the crowd in the Capital Region. I stand out, which is great. It's a great opportunity, but that means you got to be really cognizant of what you're doing, where you are, who's around you, and what you're saying. There's a different pressure, and it happens the minute I walk out the door of my house every single day, which is great. Again, I don't look at it as pressure. I don't look at these things as challenges. Look at them as opportunities, because if I take advantage of them as opportunities, then it's going to open the door up for my program, for myself, for our campus, for our community, and also for the next you know, minority, African-American, whatever the person is, you know, a person of color to get an opportunity to lead a program, great. Or if it just means that, hey, there's a guy that at one time was at a program like Temple or Boston University, he gets his next opportunity to be a high major assistant coach because he kind of looks like the profile that I had. And somebody might say that guy was successful. So maybe the guy looks just like him and has the same profile as him. Maybe it's Hamlet Tibbs from my staff, which is great. You know, that's why we do what we do. And I push my guys hard. You know, this is a situation where like they've said it, like, you give us a lot and I push them to grow because if they grow, I grow and I get better and our team gets better.
Bruiser, you've been at this thing a long time. What are some of the things that you've thought about, that you've approached, that you've shared with some of these guys that are part of your family when it comes to being an African-American coach? What are some of the responsibilities that you felt? How have you approached that aspect of coaching?
Well, one of the things I always tell my guys is, your book is judged by its cover. Let's be real. I mean, like, if people say, oh, don't judge your book by its cover. Well, we are judged by that cover. And that's real. That's a real point of it. So you got to be ready for your opportunity. People got to look at you and say, man, he's an asset to us. We're not necessarily get opportunities for people to get to know us. I hate to say that. As a minority coach, but I've been doing this for a long time. I've seen it. So your book, your cover better be good. They better look at your cover and say, all right, this guy has a chance. Let me see what I can do with this guy. So that's over the years have been, I think a lot of things have changed over the years. I would hope that we get rope, because that's another thing. We don't necessarily always get a lot of rope. If we don't have success right away, we're gone. So I hope over the next few years that changes. I think an opportunity, especially over the last 2 years, I think our opportunities have become greater. Now, give us a little rope. Give us a little chance to maybe have not have success, to have success, because that's not always happened to them. You know, I look at my own opportunity. I was there for 15 years, had a good time. I had 2 losing seasons. I was gone. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it is the reality of it. But if we don't think that our book is not judged by its cover, then we're fooling ourselves. And we have to be able to look at people, have to be able to look at us and say, okay, there's an opportunity for him. And now I hope with us getting more opportunities, we get a little bit more rope to build, because we don't always get an opportunity to build. But this was a good year for us. It's a good year for minority coaches. A lot of guys got opportunities, and I hope to take advantage of it, because in the end, they will say, you know what? I want to get a guy like him. And that makes more opportunities for us. And that's the big, the tough part of this business. Like I said, I thought this year was a really good year for us in terms of opportunity. And I hope everybody takes advantage of it and the people give us a little bit of opportunity down the end.
What do you think is the biggest obstacle to more African-American coaches getting an opportunity like Dwayne got at the University at Albany?
Is not in the room.
Yeah.
Not in the room. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? You hire people like yourself.
Right.
I mean, it's nothing wrong with that, though. That's my thing. You know, people say, well, you know, we get opportunity, but you're not. I was at Drexel for 15 years. I'm really the only black coach in the whole athletic department. You know what I mean? There was no, you know, associate AD or AD or anything like, even the other coaches, you know, were all white. So I think you hire people that like yourself. And I think that's one of the big things about giving people opportunity. You got to have some people that say to themselves, like, I've been able to work with a guy like that. I think that's big. You know what I mean? I think people understand that. John Calipari came up with the thing this year with the McClendon and helping out, getting people hired in the athletic departments with the McClendon Project Minorities. We had a lot of conversations about that. You know, we had a lot of conversations about why don't blacks get hired? You know why blacks don't get hired? There's nobody in the room that's like them. And the athletic department is almost all white. So you know what? You want to hire people like yourselves. And I'll be honest with you, most black people going to hire black people like themselves. So I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, so you're going to hire people like yourselves. So the majority of it is white. You're going to hire majority white people. I mean, so that's the big thing. I think we got to get more people involved with college athletics in the decision-making process. When we do that, we'll have more opportunities in that way. Not just basketball, all sports. I mean, football, I mean, all sports would be in that situation. So I think that's the big thing right there. And I think the McClendon Project and what they've done with that, it might not happen right away, but down the road, I think it'd be more advantageous for most opportunities. But right now, it's just us. I mean, it's not a lot of us that's involved with administration in terms of the decision-making process. We're just not involved with it. I mean, that's what happens. But when we get more and more people that's involved with the decision-making process, then we'll have more opportunities.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think one of the things, and I can't remember where I read this or saw this, but I thought it was one of the most intelligent sort of takes on this whole situation is when you think about sports, and again, we could take the race piece of it out of it, for just a second, but you have people who think there's a path, like I want to be a player and I'm going to make my living in basketball as a pro player, whether I'm going to be good enough to make the NBA, which obviously 99% of basketball players are never going to get an opportunity to do, or maybe I do get to play professionally in Europe or somewhere, but there's so many other different ways that you can be involved in athletics and be involved in sports. And you think about, Bruiser, what you're talking about, getting more people involved in the athletic department. Or now you think about somebody who could be an expert in analytics and the number of people who have been hired in professional front offices that are math majors that maybe don't even have that sports background. And those are people that end up making decisions. And I think if we can get a greater diversity of, again, thinking about racial diversity, thinking about gender diversity and the opportunity that women coaches may have to coach men, which obviously it's been vice versa. We got a lot of men coaching women, but we don't have a lot of women coaching men. And to your point, Bruiser, I think, you know, people hire what they're comfortable with. People hire people that have been around them. They say, hey, look, I played sports. My coach was a white man. That's who I see in that particular role. And I think it's a really great point that you have to have people in the room that are going to make decisions that have a mindset of, there's more to it than just this one stereotypical, this is what I see when I picture a coach. And you got to have people in there who can see the whole picture. And that's going to open up opportunities for everybody. Dwayne, what are your thoughts on that in terms of getting more people, more decision makers in the room? How do we do that? You have any thoughts on how we get more people involved in that? Is it education? What do we do in order to make that happen?
Yeah, I think it's important that, Sherita Freeman, for instance, who's the AD at Lafayette, I think needs to be an education about what that job looks like. I think it's easy to look at what a basketball coach does. Not many people know what an athletic director does, right? They, in the sport of basketball, they see him sit at the scorer's table at games, but what are they doing? They're, you know, controlling budgets, they're marketing, they're fundraising, they're representing the athletic program for the university, but I think people only understand it for, right, the big sports, men's, women's basketball, and football. Well, what about how that impacts field hockey? And I think if we were working really smart and working at a higher level, we'd educate our student athletes about what an athletic director and a deputy athletic director does. So now that inspires them to do the job, because the storyline for many ADs are that it all started with them as an athlete in some sport, some discipline. Going back to Sherita Freeman, you know, she's an Ivy League educated woman. She's a close friend. We worked at Temple. She's now the AD at Lafayette. So we need to celebrate her more in as many spaces as we can to inspire somebody else to take that job. There's a lot of athletes that finish playing, don't know what they want to do. They get to the coaching. Why can't they get into administration? And to Bruce's point, we got to get people in the room and to the table, but we got to push guys there. It needs to be an opportunity there. Again, kids go to be a grad assistant to get a degree and get an entry-level opportunity. Why are we not doing those same things? And I think the people, again, that look like Bruiser and myself, they have to open up those doors and spend some time and some sweat equity and move some money around to create more opportunities. And it might not be a minority student sometimes. It might just be a regular student athlete or another student that wants that job. But I think, again, over time, it's going to open up more opportunities for more minorities to be in leadership capacities. And I think that's reflective everywhere you go. I think every business you go into, there's a lot of talented people in the world that nobody knows about because they can't get an opportunity. I mean, there's really good basketball coaches that are just high school basketball coaches. That could be great college basketball coaches if given the opportunity. I mean, look at Greg Popovich. If he doesn't get certain opportunities, he's not where he is right now. He could have been in Sonoma coaching, you know, basketball, which is fine. Right? He's still successful in that capacity, but everybody needs a break in some way, shape, or form. We just need to get people to understand how good of a life and an opportunity that can be. It's just, you may not be, it's not as sexy walking out of the locker room on game day, but that guy impacts a lot of people and he can change a lot of people's lives and do some really cool things.
I think that lack of awareness of different paths, you know, you're talking about, hey, coaching is what we see on TV during March Madness. I want to be that. I don't necessarily see that athletic director position. There isn't that glamour. There isn't being the behind the scenes analytics person, being somebody who's in college administration. It's not something that people are seeing every day. But yet, if we can make our student athletes, our regular students, aware that, look, you may love sports, you might love the game of basketball. Well, guess what? There's more than one way to be involved in the game for your entire life than just being a player or a coach. There's so many other ways that you can impact and use sports, use the game of basketball to further yourself and then eventually further the athletes and the people that you come in contact with. And to me, it always comes back to that education piece and making sure that people are aware of what paths are out there for them to be able to follow so they can have the kind of impact that you guys are talking about. To me, it just seems like that's really where we have to put the emphasis. And I think, Bruiser, what you were talking about, you know, with McClendon thing, I think that's something that's the direction that's headed, correct?
Yes. Yes. Without a doubt. You know, McClendon, it's funny because Marcus Jarman, who's the athletic director at the UCLA, and I read his story. He talked about how, you know, he wanted to be in the college athletics. And it wasn't even the athletic people who put him down with McClendon. It was his advisor, his academic advisor at the school that said, yo, you need to look into this program. And this program got into Ohio U, became the, you know, the AD at BC, then he went to UCLA. But again, it's all about the opportunity. And not only that, too, somebody directing you and putting you on the right path to that opportunity. And I think if more people, in talking about this, and I've had a lot, now I know a lot of people that's in college athletics, and I would say to them, why don't you have more Black people in your athletic department? One of the things they always used to say to me was, we don't get a lot of applicants. I mean, like, you know, we as much as we want to say, yeah, why we don't hire, we only get for a position, we might get one Black applicant. You know what I mean? So if you can get more applicants, then you'll get more opportunities. But you also have to be able to say, you know what? Okay, this is an opportunity for you. Somebody has to direct them in that way. Like as an assistant coach, Kills, I want to get in college basketball. So he comes and talks to me and says, I want to get in it. Okay, this is your path. Let me talk to some people for you. Let me do that. That's what it's all about. You know, that's one of the things I think as it goes on, if the McClendon project is what it's supposed to be, eventually we'll start having that. I think comfortability is very important. You have to be comfortable with hiring the people that you've been around. And again, I go back to, I'm going to hire somebody like me. But if you're comfortable with anybody else, I actually say it in recruiting. If a kid, I've always said this, if you're a kid who's played for white coaches your whole life, it's hard for you to play for a Black coach. It's hard for your family to say, you know what? I'm going to give my kid over to you. But if you're a guy that's actually played for some Black coaches, whether it's AAU, whether it's high school, then it's easier for you to play for a Black coach if you're a white kid. So comfortability, I think, becomes very important in all of this. And once you've been around more people, you'll be more comfortable, then we'll get more different diversity within the departments that you work in. And I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. Jason, you want to jump in with your current events question?
So obviously you guys know the whole thing that the Supreme Court ruled today, and NCAA made the announcement that athletes are going to be allowed to use their likeness. So I just was curious how that's going to impact your programs. Obviously, I think they're a little bit different with Bruiser being at Kentucky and Bruiser being at Kentucky and Dwayne being at Albany. But I'm assuming there are some ramifications for you, Dwayne. So I don't know who wants to answer that first, but I thought it was especially relevant since that came out today, the NCAA statement that Mark Emmert put out. So yeah. I don't know who wants to field this one first. Dwayne, you want to go first?
I think Bruiser's version is going to be more compelling, but you know, when I was at Marquette last year, I mean, we did a deal with Influencer. We were preparing for this moment. I mean, people put a lot of time into it. I think the schools in the SEC, the ACC, the Big Ten that are associated with big football programs, they have a leg up because they're going in this thing hard. I mean, this is a huge opportunity. And I saw a story about Georgia Tech. You know, they did this unique thing where they went into the kids' hometowns and put up billboards because they were trying to attract people for this moment right now. So they're rolling. For us, I think we're trying to educate our student athletes about what the opportunity is. And then I think when they get on campus in 6 or 7 days, we need to educate them about, okay, this is where we are. And now here's the different people that we've associated with to help you, right? And now it's on you. Like, they have to find those opportunities on their own. But I think for us, it's like there's Bruiser at the top of the mountain, and it's got to trickle down a little bit. And there's going to be some mistakes by people, right? Like, there's going to be some opportunities that people didn't see, and then it will settle down. And there'll be stuff for our guys. I think one of the coolest things, if it was up to me, if I was king of the world, kids should go home and run camps. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
And run a basketball camp, and you're.
I don't know anyone who did that, Mike.
Yeah, like, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great one for kids to do, and I think there's so much for our program. I think there's opportunity, but then I think there's even more opportunity, especially for some of these kids that come from, you know, unique communities where they could really maximize themselves. But we'll do our part to build brand awareness. And then, you know, I think we'll learn what this community is. Now for us, it's a little different. You know, we don't have pro sports here. So I do think small markets, like you look at a place like Boise, Idaho, those kids could kill it. And now I think we have to find our own unique opportunities here in the capital region.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like you got a local car dealership or whatever, and you got a college basketball player that can go out there and just put together a 30-second commercial. I mean, to me, that seems like, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer on both sides. Not a huge commitment from the player and the business. I'm sure when you talk about, again, a local celebrity in a place where that college, it's a college town, and those players are, you know, are looked up to by everybody in the community. I mean, it's just, again, there's probably a ton of things that we can't really anticipate, as you were saying, Dwayne, that there's going to be opportunities that people don't even see or aren't even aware of yet. Bruiser, from your point of view, obviously Kentucky, a whole nother different level in terms of the awareness, in terms of the player and what their ultimate future may be in the game. So just talk a little bit about how you guys are kind of approaching this and maybe what you've talked about as a staff, maybe anticipating this coming down the road.
Well, the opportunities here are big, but they don't give out free money. And it's a hustle. You want to make money, you got to hustle at it. But also, too, a big part of for your hustle is in between the lines. If you don't perform, you're not getting the money. So that's one of the things we talk about with our guys. Like, it as much as you want to say, oh, I'm going to pick this car dealer, if you go and you average 2 points a game, that car deal is not giving you any money. I mean, like it's about being in between the lines. In between the lines of the basketball court makes a big deal for what you want to do. Your opportunities can be great here because we're a state. We got those pro sports. This is your pro team. So if you're a guy that maximizes what you need to do in terms of your basketball playing, then your opportunities are great. If you don't, your opportunities are not. Like I said, you know, any hustle is about how hard you work at it. One of the things I think that kids have to realize, and we talked about a lot here, is everybody's not going to make the same. You know what I mean? And everybody's not going to come at you. If you don't perform on the field or the basketball court, you're not going to get that money. So that's one of the things we've talked about here, because the opportunities are great here. We don't have a sport. We don't have a college team. We don't have a professional team. It's a situation where a lot of guys really, I mean, UK basketball throughout the state is unbelievable. You know, you could go on a, if you're a good player, you can go on a autograph tour and make tons of money. You know what I mean? But you got to be a good player. So it's not going to be there for everybody. If everybody is, but you've got to be able to do that. It's going to be interesting, because here the opportunities are there, but who takes advantage of it, and who do they like? Who do you like? If you're a big star, man, you can do a lot of things here. If you're not, you know what? You're not going to get that much. And I think that's one of the misnomers of the whole situation. Everybody thinks I'm gonna get rich. It's not that easy. And like I said, they don't give out free money. You know what I mean? You got to work at it. And everybody has to understand that when they come to what we're going to do with the NIL. I would say the top three people on your team, they'll make a lot. After that, it's a little bit different. You know what I mean? You got a major football team, your quarterback, your running back, your wide receiver, your All-Americans. Yes. Other than that, you're going to be picking crumbs. So guys have to understand that in those situations. Here, your top three basketball players, one of the things I've learned is, what's your following? How many people you got on Instagram or Twitter? If you only got 30,000 people, you're not going to make a lot of money. You know what I mean? You got a couple hundred thousand. That's one of the things I've learned, because I'm not part of that. I don't do those things. But the people who have come and talked to us about this said, you better have a following. If you don't have a following, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't care, you know, how it is. You have to build your following. You have to build your brand. You know, one of the things we really talk a lot about here is building your brand. If you build your brand, you got a chance to make some money. If you don't build your brand, you ain't making anything. So it's an interesting situation. I think the kids think they're just going to get it. That's the thing I always laugh about. Oh, you just think you're going to just get money. It doesn't work like that. You know what I mean? So, you know what I mean? I remember when I first started in coaching, I didn't make no money. You know what I mean? I had to build myself to the point where I got paid. So I think that's one of the things that's a little bit of a misnomer that kids really don't understand. But the opportunities are definitely there. You got to be a little creative. In a situation like this, you have to have some guidance too, which the coaches can't give you. So you might have somebody that need to give you a little bit of guidance, and that's where you go, where your brand is. Where are you? How many Twitter followers you have? How many, you know, Instagram followers you have? All those things like that. So it's a little bit more in depth than people think. And I think that's one of the things that the kids today really don't understand at this point in time. And not only that, too, who's real, who's not. I can help you. Okay. Who can really help you? Who really can't? It's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see where it is. Like I said, a place like here, you can do a lot of good things. I mean, they got a lot of money here. They got a lot of good sponsors. They got a lot of good things. But who's willing to help you? Who's willing to be able to go in full house with you as a player? And it's going to be interesting about that. Even here, we're guessing a little bit. But we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I look at it and I'm not sure. I see the benefits. It's like anything. It's like the transfer portal. It's like all those rules. You can see the benefits on both sides of it. And yet you can see that there's also some downside to it, right? I mean, there's clearly some things that there's going to be some opportunities for kids that nobody 10 years ago could have really imagined. And yet at the same time, it's going to bring in this whole different dynamic within your team that you guys as coaching staffs are going to have to deal with and help kids navigate and figure it out. And is this guy jealous of that guy because I'm the fifth starter instead of the third starter? The third starter is getting this opportunity and I'm as good as him. How come he's getting paid for this and I'm not? And it just adds this whole other thing that, again, may or may not end up being an issue, but at this point, it's so unknown, it's so new that who knows where it ends up going. We are coming close to an hour and a half. I want to wrap up by letting you guys maybe share, Dwayne, one more thing, or just maybe give us anything that we missed in terms of your relationship with Bruiser, something else that you want to share with us and our audience to just give people an idea of how important he's been to you in your career. And then Bruiser, you can kind of throw it back after Dwayne shares his thoughts here.
Yeah, there's been moments, whether it's getting a recruit or working at Marquette or whatever, you know, he was proud, you know, because he's part of me getting to that moment. And I could hear him kind of being kind of choked up when we talked about when I got the job and after my press conference. And that's it's a special feeling, because to get to, like, I get to live my dream, right? This has been a dream of mine and I get to live it. But I carry him in the gym and I carry him into the office, because if I'm not successful, I let him down, right? Because, to your point, like, he's opened doors for me. He's helped guide me. He's been there for me. Like, I lost my job once, you know, and he kind of just coached me through that. And that means a lot. And like I said, he goes from like a coach to a friend. That's unique. That's special. And I know when I have success, he's going to be as happy as can be. When I have failure, he's going to be like, I got to help him. I got to help pick him back up. He's a part of that. Those things are really important to me, because I get to carry his legacy. Like, you know, that's unique. I get to say that, again, I wasn't, when I set out on this journey, I didn't have the success other people had. So I had to outwork people. I had to build relationships in a different way. I had to go about it. Some people told me I wouldn't be able to get here. I'm here. And I'm driving myself to be successful because people like him betted on me and they put their word on it. That means a lot. My dad didn't have all the answers for this, because this is not his world. And I turned to Bruiser Flint and probably four other people to figure this out. And I'm here and I get to live it. And I say to people all the time, when I set out to do it and I said I want to coach and be an assistant coach, he never told me I couldn't do it, because he realized I could. And that means a lot, because for somebody like him, he could easily been like, man, I don't know about this one for you. on two dates are coming up in the fall. You know, I'm going to coach my first game, and he's coming in the gym with me. And I'm going to try as hard as I can to make sure that first day goes right, because there's going to be a bunch of people that are going to be proud of me and our team, and he'll be one of them. And then we're going to play them, and that's going to be interesting. That's a whole nother world. But it meant a lot for me to do this and be able to, whether he's an assistant coach or the head coach, it doesn't matter to me, to be able to do that in my first year. That's because you don't get to do this a lot, and you don't get opportunities like this. And I get to control where my team goes. We're going there. We're going to play that game. I'm going to give him a big hug. It's going to be special for both of us. And then after that game, we're going to go on our separate journeys. We're going to talk a lot. We're going to cheer each other on. I love him. I mean, he's the closest thing to family, you know, outside the people that have the same blood as me. And without him, I wouldn't be where I am.
Bruiser, what do you think that conversation is going to be like after you guys match up? Let's forget about the outcome of the game, but just the opportunity to watch Dwayne as a head coach. What do you anticipate that conversation being all about? What do you think you'd say to him? What do you think he's going to say to you in that moment after coaching that first game?
And I hope we beat them by a lot, but that's.
Oh, I think that goes without saying, man.
I get to say this as motivation. I need to make sure I get a copy of this recording.
There you go. We got it, man. I'm getting it to you. You got it.
Every day I looked at this wall at Kentucky, because Kentucky won a 2000 game against me at Drexel. So I walked by this one space that got 2K on it. And it says Kentucky 88, Drexel 44. So I look at it that way. But I will say this, though, you know, when you're a coach, you know, you want to see your guys have success, because it's all about the relationships and how you think you affected those guys in your 4 years that they're, or whatever, the opportunity that they're around, the time that they're around. to see DeWayne be able to get the head coaching job, whether he plays this or not, has made me unbelievably proud. And not only that, too, I've seen his journey. I've been a part of it. So that lets me know that, you know, how hard he's worked. Like I said, the biggest thing about him was his reputation as a coach as he was going through the business. So I feel really good about it. Watching him just walk on the stage before he said any word, I almost started crying when I saw him at going up to the stage to get the job at Albany. Sitting, being able to talk to him because I know how hard he's worked. But it looks like being selfish, I had a part of that. I think that's one of the biggest things that I look at it. Like I said, you know, man, I had a big part of him becoming a head coach. We had a lot of conversations about getting to this journey, getting to this part of his career. But you know, I love him. I love all my guys. I feel real good about my guys who are head coaches. I have a lot of them, actually, for a guy who, you know what I mean, Ash Howard, Bashir Mason, him, even some Division III guys, Mike Connors, Brian Gorman, Matt Collier. So all those guys have worked for me and become head coaches, even a lot of guys who are high school coaches. So I've always felt this, a little selfishly, that I had something to do with that. That's one of the things that makes it good about coach. That's why you come back every day, that you see those guys have success and you feel good about that success. I know DeWayne got up and talked about me a little bit at the press conference, and that really made it, you know, made it special. It's an opportunity for those guys. I think that's your job as a head coach. I hope when he begins his job, that guys help look at him that same way. I actually have a kid Henry Fairfax, who's an independence headmaster, and he's going to get a huge job. He calls me every day, talks about it. And that makes you feel good as a coach that you know that you had a chance to be a part of their lives, and they entrust you to be part of their decision-making. I think that's one of the big things that makes it special. And I'm so proud of all my guys, especially him, because we're a little tighter than most people. You know what I mean? I have a different relationship with them than even my other guys that are head coaches. You know what I mean? Our relationship is a lot different. And to see him be able to have this success and be able to live his dream, you know, I'm always there for him. And that's what this is all about. That's what it's all about for me when you play for me. When you play for a guy, you hope you get the opportunity that guys look at you and say, you can be a part of my decision-making and my life going forward. And that makes it all worth it.
I love that, Bruiser. I think that that's something that when I think about defining success as a coach, or Jason and I are both teachers in our real jobs, when you think about defining your success, what you just said about being a part of someone else's success, that to me is really what it's all about. When you can look at and you can say, what I did as a coach, what I did as a teacher, what I did as a parent, what I did as a business person, whatever, that I was able to have an impact on somebody that helped propel them to success. And I can feel that I was a part of it, and they feel that I was a part of it. To me, there's nothing better than that. And that's really, that's the definition of coaching. I mean, obviously there's a lot more that goes into it when we talk about the actual basketball and on the floor, but it ultimately comes down to 15 or 20 years down the road, when you have a guy that has success in his own career, in his own family, in his own life, that's when you, as you said, you feel the most proud. And that's when you feel those tears. And that's when you feel that pride, when somebody that you had an impact on gets up and has success. And that's been a theme that's kind of run through everything that we've done on the podcast. I know it's something that DeWayne has repeatedly said every time, DeWayne, we've had you on, there's been some form of that particular theme, wanting to have an impact on people and you sharing the people that have had an impact on you. And Bruiser obviously is no different in your career, and the things that he's been able to do for you and for the other guys that are part of his family, the things that you're going to do for the people that are going to be part of your family as you continue to build your career. So I want to thank both of you for taking the time out of your schedule. Bruiser, it was a pleasure meeting you. We really appreciate you coming on and being a part of this series with DeWayne. And DeWayne, obviously, as always, I think Jason and I feel extremely indebted to you to be able to open up kind of your program to us over the course of this year. And it's going to continue to be a fascinating journey as we watch you start your head coaching
career. I think, Mike, I want to say something though. I think
we
should get the commitment that after they play one another, we get them back on the podcast and talk about the experience.
All right, that's good. That's a bad way.
I'm not ready to commit to that one.
Well, we might. Hey, we're not going to get you on 5 minutes after the game. How about that? We'll give you
right after the game.
In the locker room.
Live from Lexington. Here we are.
We'll give you a grace period. We'll give you a grace period. That's a good idea, Jason. I like them. See, look at man. There's the brains of the organization over here.
Coming out the bullpen with that one. He came out of nowhere with that.
He's thinking outside the box, man. I like it, Jay. That's good. That's good stuff. Well, again, thank you guys both for jumping on tonight. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.